Anne arrived at the shelter looking tired and old. She greeted Sax curtly, her old antipathy as strong as ever. Sax didn't know what to say to her. Was this a new problem? He decided to wait until Peter had talked to her and see if that made any difference. He waited. Nowadays, if he didn't talk, no one bothered him. Advantages everywhere. She came back from a talk with Peter to eat a meal with the other Reds in their little commons, and, yes, she stared at him curiously. Looking over the heads of the others at him as if inspecting a new cliff on the Martian landscape, intent and objective, evaluative. A status change in a dynamic system is a data point that speaks to a theory. Supporting or troubling? What are you? Why are you doing this? He met her stare calmly, tried to field it, to turn it around. Yes, I am still Sax. I have changed. Who are you? Why haven't you changed? Why do you still look at me like that? I have experienced an injury. The pre-morbid individual is not there anymore, not quite. I have been given an experimental treatment. I feel fine. I am not the man you knew. And why haven't you changed? If enough data points trouble the theory may be wrong. If the theory is basic, the paradigm may have to change. She sat down to eat. It was doubtful she had read his mind in that much detail, but a great pleasure, nevertheless, to be able to meet her eye. He got in the little cockpit with Peter, and just after the time slip, they bounced down the bedrock runway, accelerating hard and tilting up at the black sky, the big, streamlined space plane vibrating under them. Sax lay back, crushed into his seat, and waited for the plane to curve over that asymptotic hill at the top of its course, slowing as it rose less steeply until it was in a gentle rise through the high stratosphere, making the transition from plane to rocket as the atmosphere thinned to its last attenuated level, 100 kilometers high, where the gases of the Russell cocktail were annihilated daily by incoming UV rays. The plane's skin was glowing with heat. Through the filtered glass of the cockpit, it was the color of the sun at sunset. No doubt it was affecting their night vision. Below, the planet was all dark, except for very faint patches of starlit glaciers in Hellas Basin. They were rising still. A widening gyre. Stars packed the blackness of what looked like an enormous black hemisphere standing on an enormous black plain. Night sky, night Mars. They rose and rose again. The incandescent rocket was translucent yellow, hallucinatorily bright and sleek. The latest from Vishniac, designed in part by Spencer and made of an intermetallic compound, chiefly gamma-titanium aluminum, rendered superplastic for the manufacture of heat-resistant engine parts as well as the exterior skin, which dimmed a bit as they rose higher and it cooled. He could imagine the beautiful latticework of the gamma-titanium aluminum patterned in a tapestry of nodoids and catenoids like hooks and eyes, vibrating madly with the heat. They were building such things these days. Ground-to-space planes. Walk out into your backyard and fly to Mars in an aluminum can. Sax described what he wanted to do after this. Peter laughed. Do you think Vishniac can do it? Oh, yeah. There are some design problems. I know. But they'll solve them. I mean, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to be a rocket scientist. That's very true. Peter sang to pass the hours. Sax joined in when he knew the words, as in 16 tons, a satisfying song. Peter told the story of how he had escaped from the falling elevator, what it had been like to float in an EVA suit alone for 2 days. Somehow it gave me a taste for it, that's all. I know it sounds strange. I understand. The shapes out here were so big and pure, the color of things. What was it like to learn to talk again? I have to concentrate to do it. I have to think hard. Things surprise me all the time. Things I used to know and forgot. Things I never knew. Things I learned just before the injury. That period is usually occluded forever, but it was so important. When I was working around the glacier, I have to talk to your mom about that. It isn't like she thinks, you know. The land. The new plants out there. The yellow butterfly sun. It doesn't have to be. You should talk to her. She doesn't like me. Talk to her when we get back. The altimeter indicated 250 kilometers above the surface. The plane plowed up toward Cassiopeia. Every star had a distinct color, different from any other. Or there were at least 50 of them. Below them, on the eastern edge of the black disk, the Terminator appeared, zebra-banded sandy ochre and shadowy black. The thin crescent of sunlit Mars gave him the sudden clear perception of the disk as a great spheroid, a ball spinning through the galaxy of stars. The great huge continent mountain of Elysium bulked over the horizon, its shape perfectly delineated by the horizontal shadows. They were looking down the length of its long saddleback, Hecate's Tholus almost hidden behind the cone of Elysium Mons, Albor Tholus off to the side. "There it is," Peter said, and pointed up through the clear cockpit. Above them, to the east, the eastern edge of the aerial lens was silver in the morning light, the rest of it still in the planet's shadow. "Are we close enough yet?" Sax asked. "Almost." Sax looked down again at the thickening crescent of the morning. There, on the dark, rough highlands of Hesperia, a cloud of smoke was billowing up from the dark surface just beyond the Terminator into the morning light. Even at their height, they were in that cloud still, in the part that was no longer visible. The lens itself was surfing on that invisible thermal, using its lift and the pressure of sunlight to hold its position over the burn zone. Now the entire lens was in the sunlight, looking like an enormous silver parachute with nothing underneath it. Its silver was also violet, sky-colored. The cup was a section of a sphere, 1,000 kilometers across, its center some 50 kilometers above its rim, spinning like a frisbee. There was a hole at the peak where the sunlight poured straight through. Everywhere else, the circular mirror strips that made up the cup were reflecting the light from the sun and the Soleta, inward and down onto a moving point on the surface below, bringing to bear so much light that it was igniting basalt. The lens mirrors heated up to almost 900 degrees Kelvin, and the liquefied rock down there was reaching 5,000 degrees Kelvin, degassing volatiles. Into Sax's mind, as he considered the great object flying over them, came the image of a magnifying glass, held over dry weeds and an aspen branch. Smoke, flame, fire. The concentrated rays of the sun, photon assault. "Aren't we close enough yet? It looks like it's right over us." "No, we're well out from under the edge. It wouldn't do to get under that thing, although I suppose the focus wouldn't be right to fry us. Anyway, it's moving over the burn zone at almost 1,000 kilometers an hour. Like jets when I was young." "Huh." Green lights blinked on one of his consoles. "Okay, here we go." He pulled back on the stick and the plane stood in its tail, rising straight at the lens, which was still another 100 kilometers higher than they were, and well to the west of them. Peter pushed a button on the console. The whole plane jerked as a bank of fletched missiles appeared from under the plane's stubby wings, wafting with them and then igniting like magnesium flares and shooting up and away toward the lens. Pinpricks of yellow fire against that huge silvery UFO eventually disappearing from sight. Sax waited, lips pursed, and tried to stop his blinking. The front edge of the lens began to unravel. It was a flimsy thing, nothing but a great spinning cup of solar sail bands, and it came apart with startling rapidity, its front edge rolling under it until it was tumbling forward and down, trailing long looping streamers which looked like the tangled tails of several broken kites, all falling together. 1.5 billion kilograms of solar sail material, in fact, all unraveling as it fluttered down in its long trajectory, looking slow because it was so big, though probably the great mass of material was still moving at well above terminal velocity. A good portion of it would burn up before it hit the surface. Silica rain. Peter turned and followed it in its descent, keeping well to the east of it, and so they could see it below them, there in the violet morning sky, as the main mass of it heated to an incandescent glare and caught fire, like a great yellow comet with a hairy tangled silver tail dropping down to the tawny planet. All fall down. "Good shot," Sax said. Back in Wallace Crater, they were welcomed as heroes. Peter deflected all congratulations. It was Sax's idea. The flight itself was no big deal. Just another reconnaissance except for the firing. I don't know why we didn't think of it before. "They'll just drop another one into position," Anne said from the edge of the crowd, staring at Sax with a very curious expression. "But they're so vulnerable," Peter said.
"Surface-to-space missiles," Sax said, feeling nervous. Can you inventory all orbiting objects?"
"We already have," Peter said. "Some of them we don't have ID'd, but most are obvious."
"I'd like to see the list."
"I'd like to talk to you," Anne told him darkly.
And the rest quickly left the room, wagging their eyebrows at each other like a bunch of Art Randolphs. Sax sat down in a bamboo chair. It was a little room without a window. It could have been one of the barrel vaults in Underhill back in the beginning. The shape was right, the textures. Brick was such a stable staple. Anne pulled a chair over and sat across from him, leaning forward to stare in his face. She looked older. The vaunted Red Leader, vaunted, gaunted, haunted. He smiled.
"Are you about due for a gerontological treatment?" his mouth said, surprising them both.
Anne brushed the question off as an impertinence.
"Why did you want to bring down the lens?"
she said, her gaze boring into him.
"I didn't like it."
"I know that," she said. "But why?"
"It wasn't necessary. Things are warming up fast enough. There's no reason to go faster. We don't even need much more heat. And it was releasing very large amounts of carbon dioxide. That will be hard to scrub. And it was very nicely stuck. It's hard to get CO2 out of carbonates. As long as one doesn't melt the rock, it stays." He shook his head. "It was stupid. They were just doing it because they could. Canals. I don't believe in canals."
"So it just wasn't the right kind of terraforming for you?"
"That's right." He met her stare calmly. "I believe in the terraforming outlined in Dorsa Brevia. You signed off, too, as I recall."
She shook her head.
"No, but the Reds signed."
She nodded.
"Well, it makes sense to me. I said this to you before. human viable to a certain elevation. Above that, air too thin and cold. Go slow. Echo poesis. I don't like any of the big new heavy industry methods. Maybe some nitrogen from Titan, but not any of the rest.
What about the oceans?
I don't know. See what happens without pumping.
What about the Saleta?
I don't know. The extra insulation means less warming needed from industrial gassing or other methods, but we could have done without it. I thought the dawn mirrors were enough.
But it's not in your hands anymore.
No.
They sat in silence for a while. Anne appeared to be thinking. Sax watched her weathered face, wondering when she had last had the treatment. Ursula recommended repeating it every 40 years at a minimum.
I was wrong, his mouth said.
As she stared at him, he tried to follow the thought. It was a matter of shapes, geometries, mathematical elegance. Cascading, recombinant chaos. Beauty is the creation of a strange attractor.
We should have waited before we started. A few decades of study of the primal state, it would have told us how to proceed. I didn't think things would change so fast. My original idea was something more like echopoesis.
She pursed her lips. But now it's too late.
Yes, I'm sorry.
He turned a palm up, inspected it. All the lines there were the same as always.
You ought to get the treatment.
I'm not taking the treatment anymore.
Oh, Anne, don't say that. Does Peter know? We need you. I mean, we need you. She got up and left the room.
His next project was more complex. Although Peter was confident, the Vishniac people were dubious. Sax explained as best he could. Peter helped. Their objections turned to practicalities. Too large? Enlist more Bogdanovists. Impossible to stealth? Interrupt the surveillance network. Science is creation, he told them.
This isn't science, Peter replied.
It's engineering. Mikhail agreed, but liked that part of it. Ecotage, a branch of ecological engineering, but very difficult to arrange.
Enlist the Swiss, Sax told them, or at least let them know.
They don't like surveillance anyway. Tell Praxis. Things began to shape up. But it was a long time before he and Peter took off in a space plane again. This time, they rocketed out of the stratosphere entirely and then far above it, 20,000 kilometers above it, until they were closing on Deimos, and then making a rendezvous with it. The gravity of the little moon was so slight that it was more a docking than a touchdown. Jackie Boone, who had helped on the project, mostly to be close to Peter, the shape was clear, guided the plane in. As they approached, Sax had an excellent view through the cockpit window. Deimos's black surface looked to be covered by a thick coat of dusty regolith. All the craters were nearly buried in it, their rims soft round dimples in the blanket of dust. The little oblong moon was not regular, but was rather composed of several rounded facets. A triaxial ellipsoid, almost. An old robot lander sat near the middle of Voltaire Crater, its landing pads buried, its coppery articulated struts and boxes dimmed by a fine dark dust. They had chosen their own landing site on one of the ridges between facets, where lighter bare rock protruded from the blanket of dust.
The ridges were old spallation scars marking where early impacts had napped pieces of the moonlit away. Jackie brought them down gently toward a ridge to the west of Swift and Voltaire craters. Deimos was tidally fixed, as Phobos had been, which was convenient for their project. The sub-Mars point served as 0 degrees for both longitude and latitude, a most sensible plan. Their touchdown ridge was near the equator at 90 degrees longitude, about a 10-kilometer walk from the sub-Mars point. As they approached the ridge, the rim of Voltaire disappeared under the black, curved horizon. Dust blew away from the ridge as the plane's rockets shot exhaust over it. There was only a few centimeters of dust covering the bedrock. Carbonaceous chondrite, 5 billion years old. They docked with a hard thump, bounced away, slowly drifted down again. He could feel the pull toward the floor of the plane, but it was very slight. Probably he didn't weigh more than a couple of kilograms, if that. Other rockets began to land on the ridge to either side of them, kicking clouds of dust into the vacuum where they drifted slowly down. All the planes bounced on impact, then came down gently through their dust clouds. Within half an hour, there were 8 planes lined up on the ridge, running along it to the tight horizons in both directions. Together, they made a weird sight, the intermetallic compounds of their rounded surfaces gleaming like chitin under the surgical glare of unfiltered sunlight, the clarity of the vacuum making all their edges over-focused, dreamlike. Each plane carried a component of the system, robot drillers and tunnelers and stamps, water collection galleries there to melt the veins of ice in Deimos. A processing plant to separate out heavy water, about 1 part in 6,000 of the ordinary water. Another plant to process deuterium from the heavy water. A small tokamak to be powered by a deuterium-deuterium fusion reaction. Lastly, guidance jets, though most of these were in planes that had landed on the other sides of the moon. The Bogdanovist technicians who had come up with the equipment were doing most of the installation. Sachs got suited up in one of the bulky pressure suits on board and went out the lock and onto the surface, thinking to look and see if the plane carrying the guidance jet for the Swift Voltaire region had landed. The big heated boots were weighted, and he was glad of it. Escape velocity was no more than 25 kilometers an hour, meaning that with a running start, one could jump right off the moon. It was quite difficult to keep his balance. Millions of tiny motions carried one along. Every step kicked up a healthy cloud of black dust, which slowly fell to the ground. There were rocks scattered on top of the dust, usually in little pockets they had made on landing. Ejecta, which had no doubt circled the moonlit many times after ejection, before dropping in again. He picked up one rock like a black baseball. Throw it at the right speed, turn around, wait for it to go around the world, catch it chest high. Out at first. A new sport. The horizon was only a few hundred meters away, and it changed markedly with every step. Crater rims, spallation ridges, and boulders popping up over the dusty edge as he trudged toward it. People back on the ridge, between the planes, already stood at a different upright than he did and were tilted away from him, like the little prince. The clarity was starting. His footprints made a deep trail through the dust. The dust clouds hanging over the footprints got lower the farther back they were until they settled 4 or 5 steps back. Peter came out of the lock and walked in his direction, and Jackie followed. Peter was the only man Sachs had ever seen Jackie really attracted to, in that intense, helpless manner of the orbiting object, the lovelorn yearning for orbital decay. Peter was also the only man Sachs had ever seen who didn't respond to Jackie's amorous attentions in any way. The perversity of the heart, as in his attraction to Phyllis, a woman he hadn't liked. Or, as in his desire for the approval of Anne, a woman who hadn't liked him. A woman with crazy views. But perhaps there was a rationality to it. If someone moons over you, you have to wonder at their judgment. Something like that. Now Jackie trailed Peter like a dog, and though their faceplates were a copper color, Sax could tell just by her movements that she was talking to him, cajoling him somehow. Sax turned to the common band and came in on their conversation.
"Why they're named Swift and Voltaire," Jackie said.
"Both of them predicted the existence of the Martian moons," Peter said, "in books they wrote a century before the moons were seen. In Gulliver's Travels, Swift even gives their distances from the planet and their orbit times, and he wasn't that far off."
"You're kidding."
"No."
"How in the world did he do that?"
"I don't know. Blind luck, I guess." Sax cleared his throat.
"Sequence."
"What?"
they said. "Venus had no moon. Earth, 1. Jupiter, 4. Mars should have had 2. Since they couldn't see them, they were probably small and close, therefore fast."
Peter laughed.
"Swift must have been a smart man."
"Or his source. But it was still blind luck. The sequence being a coincidence."
They stopped on another spallation ridge from which they could see the rim of Swift Crater as a nearly buried ridge on the next horizon. A small gray rocket plane stood on the black dust like a miracle. Above them, Mars filled most of the sky, a vast orange world. Night was falling across the eastern crescent. Isidis was directly above them, and though he couldn't make out burrows, the plains to the north of it were patched with great white splotches, glaciers meeting up to become ice lakes, and the beginnings of an ice sea. Oceanus Borealis. A corrugated layer of clouds lay pasted right against the land, reminding him suddenly of what Earth had looked like from the Ares. That was a cold front coming down Syrtis Major. The pattern of white clouds was just what it would have been on Terra, cyclical waves of condensation particles. He left the ridge, walked back toward the plains. The tall, stiff boots were the only things that kept him upright, and his ankles hurt, like walking on the sea bottom, only with no resistances. Universe ocean. He reached down and dug in the dust. No bedrock for 10 centimeters, then 20. It could have been 5 or 10 meters deep or even more. The dust clouds he had kicked up dropped back to the surface in about 15 seconds. The dust was so fine that in any kind of atmosphere they might have stayed in suspension indefinitely, but in the vacuum they fell like anything else. Ejecta. There simply wasn't much to pull them back. One might be able to kick dust into space. He crossed a low ridge and abruptly could see over the sloping plain of the next facet. It was so obvious that the moonlet was shaped like some Paleolithic hand tool, with facets napped off by ancient strikes. Triaxial ellipsoid. Curious that it had such a circular orbit, one of the most circular in all the solar system. Not what you would expect of a captured asteroid, nor of ejecta flung up from Mars in one of the big impacts. Leaving what? Very old capture. With other bodies in other orbits to regularize it. Nap, nap. Spall. Spallation. Language was so beautiful. Rocks striking rocks in the ocean of space. Knocking bits off and flying away. Until they all either fell into the planet or skittered off. All but 2. 2 out of billions. Moon bomb. Gun stand. Rotating just faster than Mars above, so that any point on the Martian surface had it in the sky for 60 hours at a time. Convenient. The known was more dangerous than the unknown, no matter what Michelle said. Clomp, clomp, on the virgin rock of a virgin moon with a virgin mind. The little prince. The planes rising over the horizon looked absurd, like insects from a dream, chitinous, articulated, colorful, tiny in the starry black on the dust-blanketed rock. He climbed back into the lock.
It was months later, and he was alone in Ekkis Chasma when the robots on Deimos finished their construction and the starter deuterium ignited the drive engine. 1,000 tons of crushed rock were thrown out by the engine every second at a speed of 200 kilometers per second, all flying out tangent to the orbit and in the orbit plane. In 4 months, when about 0.5% of the moon's mass had been ejected, the engine would cut off. Deimos would then be 614,287 kilometers away from Mars, according to Sachs's calculations, and on its way completely out of Mars's influence to become a free asteroid again. Now it flew in his night sky, an irregular gray potato, less luminous than Venus or Terra, except that there was a new comet blazing out of its side. Quite a sight. News all over both worlds. Scandalous. Controversial even in the resistance, where people argued pro and con. All that squabbling. Hiroko was going to get tired of it and light out for the territory. He could feel the shape of it. Yes, no, what, where, who did it, why? Anne came on the wrist to ask the same questions, looking furious. It was a perfect weapons platform, Sachs said. If they made it into a military base like they did Phobos, we would have been helpless under it.
So you did this on the off chance it might get turned into a military base?
If Arkady and his crew hadn't fixed Phobos on the off chance, we couldn't have dealt with it. We would have been killed. Anyway, the Swiss heard it was going to happen.
Anne was shaking her head, staring at him as if he were mad. A crazed saboteur. Rather a case of the pot calling the kettle black, in his opinion. Resolutely, he met the look. When she cut the connection, he shrugged and called the Bogdanovists.
The Reds have a catalog of all the objects in orbit around Mars. Then we need surface-to-space delivery systems. Spencer will help. Equatorial silos. Inactive moholes. Do you understand?
They said they did. You didn't have to be a rocket scientist. And so, if it ever came to it again, they would not be pounded from space. Sometime later, he couldn't be sure how long, Peter appeared on the little screen of the boulder car Sachs had borrowed from Desmond.
Sachs, I'm in contact with some friends who work on the elevator, and with Deimos accelerating, the cable oscillations to dodge it have been thrown off in their timing. It looks like the next pass in its orbit might collide with the elevator, but my friends can't get the cable's navigation AI to respond to them. Apparently it's really hardened to outside input, to prevent sabotage, you know. And the idea of Deimos changing speed is something they can't get it to accept. Do you have any suggestions?
Let it see for itself.
What?
Feed the data on Deimos into it. It must get that anyway.
And it's programmed to avoid it. Direct its attention to the data. Explain what happened.
Trust it.
Trust it?
Well, talk to it.
We're trying, Sachs, but the anti-sabotage programming is real strong.
It's running the oscillations to avoid Deimos. As long as that's in its list of goals, you should be okay. Just give it the data.
Okay, we'll try.
It was night, and Sachs went outside. Wandering in the darkness under the immense cliff of the Great Escarpment in the region just north of where Kasei Vallis broke through the wall. Sei meant star in Japanese. Ka, fire. Fire star. It was the same in Chinese, in which huo was the syllable the Japanese pronounced as ka and xing, sei. A Chinese word to start with. Huo Xing, fire star burning in the sky.
They said Ka was what the little red men called it. We live on fire.
Sax was distributing seeds in the ground, the hard little nuts pushed just under the surface of the sand flooring the chasm. Johnny Fire Seed. There in the southern sky, Deimos burned, slowly losing way through the stars, rolling westward at its own slow pace. Now pushed by the pinpoint comet burst on its eastern edge. The elevator rising over Tharsis was invisible. The new Clark, perhaps one of the dimmer stars in the southwest sky, it was impossible to say. He kicked a rock by accident, bent down and planted another seed. After the seeds were all out, there were starter packets of a new lichen to distribute. A chasmoendolithic strain, very hardy, very fast to propagate, very quick to pump out oxygen. Very high surface-to-volume ratio. Very dry. A bip on the wrist. He switched the voice into his helmet intercom as he continued to take the little nuts out of his thigh pocket and shove them into the sand, careful to avoid damaging the roots of any of the sedges or other ground cover that dotted the ground like furry black rocks. It was Peter, sounding excited. Sax, Deimos is coming up on them now, and the AI seems to have acknowledged that it's not in its usual spot in its orbit. It's been mulling it over, they say. The attitude jets all through their sector have started a bit early, so we're hopeful that the system is responding.
Can't you calculate the oscillation?
Yes, but the AI is proving recalcitrant. It's a stubborn bastard. The security programs are pretty watertight. We can just figure out enough from independent calculations to see that it's going to be a pretty close pass.
Sax straightened up and tapped out calculations of his own on his wrist pad. Orbital period of Deimos had started at approximately 109,077 seconds. The drive engine had been on for some, he wasn't sure, say, a million seconds, speeding the moonlet by a significant amount already, but also expanding the radius of its orbit. He tapped away in the great silence. Usually, when Deimos passed by the elevator cable, the cable was at the full extension of its oscillation in that sector, some 50 kilometers or more away, far enough away that the gravitational perturbation was so small it didn't have to be factored into the adjustments of the cable jets. This time, the acceleration of movement outward of Deimos would throw the timing off. The cable would be moving back in toward Deimos's orbital plane too soon. So it was a matter of slowing the Clark oscillation and adjusting for that all up and down the cable. Complicated stuff, and no wonder the AI wasn't able to display what it was doing in much detail. It was likely to be busy linking up to other AIs to gain the calculating capacity necessary to perform the operation. The shapes of the situation. Mars, the cable, Clark, Deimos were beautiful to contemplate.
Okay, here it comes at them, Peter said.
Are your friends at the elevation of the orbit? Sax asked, surprised.
They're a couple 100 kilometers below it, but their elevator car is on its way up. They've linked me up to their cameras and... Hey, here it comes!
Yes! Oh! Wow!
Sax, it must have missed the cable by about 3 kilometers. It just flashed right by their camera.
A miss is as good as a mile.
What's that?
At least in a vacuum it is.
But now it was more than just a passing rock.
What about the tail of ejecta from the drive engine?
I'll ask. They ended up crossing in front of Deimos, they say.
Good.
Sax clicked off. Good foresight on the AI's part. A few more passes and Deimos would be above Clark and the cable would no longer have to dodge it. Meanwhile, as long as the navigational AI believed in the danger, as obviously it did now, they would be okay. Sax was of two minds about this. Desmond had said he would be happy to see the cable come down again, but there were few who seemed to agree with him. Sax had decided against taking unilateral action on the matter, since he wasn't sure what he felt about that tie to Earth. Best to limit unilateral action
to things he was sure about, and so he bent over and planted another seed.
This ends side 2 of cassette 13 of Green Mars. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 14.